good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Scott Looper, Rabbi of Congregation Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. Rabbi Looper attained his B.A. at UC Berkeley and M.A. from Hebrew Union College and was ordained in 1989. He spent his first 5 years at Am Shalom in Glencoe and the past 20 years at Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. He is a founding member of Lake County United and a co-organizer of To Serve the Hungry. And Rabbi Looper, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
You know, there is so much to talk about, and we're going to be getting into social issues such as poverty, immigration, gay marriage. But let's take a look a little bit at your background. You grew up in Marin County, California.
Marin.
Oh, of course. Boy, I sound like a Midwesterner,
yeah,
like I'm saying Illinois or something, huh? you know, you grew up in California. You now reside in the Midwest, but let's talk a little bit about points in between. At what point did you know that you wanted to be a rabbi? What triggered your interest?
So I would not define it as a single point or a sense of calling. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would define that. To me, it was much more organic. So when I grew up, I was the only Jewish boy in my class till fifth grade. So I think that in terms of my identity, Judaism was fairly strong. I mean, I was the Jewish kid. In the day that I grew up, religion in the schools wasn't as circumscribed as it is today.
Mm. What do you mean by that?
So what do I mean? I mean that, for instance, like I learned to sing Silent Night and, you know,
okay.
all the good
okay.
Christmas songs.
Okay.
So we learned those in school. And we had a sort of a winter holiday thing where parents would come and talk about their holidays. So we had someone from France who would talk about Christmas in France. My mom would come and talk about Hanukkah. So I think that just in terms of that identity,
mm-hmm.
Being formed in that manner,
mm-hmm.
Judaism was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that my connection really developed when I went to Israel after my sophomore year,
mm-hmm.
Just for a summer program, 6 weeks. And suddenly I was with a bunch of Jewish kids, and I'd never been with a whole bunch of Jewish kids before. Even in my high school, there weren't many Jewish students.
Was this a
students.
Mission project you went on?
No, it was actually just what's called a confirmation class trip
okay.
when we finished
mm-hmm.
10th grade.
Oh, okay.
And so we toured all around and spent time on a kibbutz and things of
oh,
that
you
sort.
Did? Okay, so you did some agricultural work.
There. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in some ways that sort of lit the fire, excuse me, of just coming into relationship with a lot of other Jewish individuals and feeling comfort
mm-hmm.
in that. I was no longer the odd man out, one might say.
You kind of found a community.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Next year, I went to Jewish camp for the first time.
Oh, okay.
And I was a counselor in training. And I would say that, you know, in terms of the impetus, I think that that really got me. You know, it wasn't a decision like I wanted to be a rabbi,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of the sense of Jewish community, it's always, and I worked at camp for a number of years after that. I went to winter camp. I went mm-hmm. to summer camp. I was a counselor for 5-6 years. And the reason that that was so attractive to me was that it was a very supportive community. It was mm-hmm. a place where I always felt accepted. It was a place where I'd never had to explain myself. So I think that, you know, in some ways, the rabbinate was almost a natural extension for me in terms
okay.
of the sense of community. When I was a junior in college, I went to Israel, studied year abroad in Jerusalem.
Now, this is when you were at Berkeley.
Correct. So
okay.
that was more academic.
Okay.
And
by the way, when I think of Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking of the 60s and 70s. Is that kind of culture still there, the very progressive kind of liberal atmosphere, or is that gone now?
You know, even when I was there, I saw it changing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was much more, I'm hesitant to say preppy, but, you know, guys were walking around in button-down shirts and stuff like that.
But they were button-down tie-dye, right?
No, they weren't. Now, I on the other hand, I did not bring pictures, but I was a good liberal, hippie sort of character.
That whole, okay.
Lots of hair.
Well, we can get into that a little bit later, okay. I guess. So then, of course, you went to Hebrew Institute. Hebrew Union Jewish Institute of Religion.
Right.
And so I guess that's the time you start to prepare to be a rabbi. What kind of courses do you take? And I don't want to get just a couple. I'm just kind of curious. I don't want to get too...
Okay, so Hebrew Union College, HUCJIR, is the Reform Movement's rabbinical school.
Mm-hmm.
It's a graduate program. So I got a BA in English at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing to do with religion. Actually,
English has to do with everything.
Yeah, everything, but much more New Testament than Old Testament in terms of
In
the writings.
Yeah, you're right.
But I would say, so anyway... HUC is a 5-year rabbinic program. You take all sorts of classes. So you learn how to give sermons. You learn how to lead liturgy. You learn about liturgy. You learn about education. You learn about history. You learn about Jewish texts. You study Hebrew. So there's a really broad range of classes. You study Bible. So I would say, and then practicum courses. So
let's talk a little bit about the Bible. When I think of Judaism, I think of the Torah, those 5 books. Is that the key to Judaism, the books of Moses, I guess they'd call that?
Okay, so we call that the 5 books of Moses, right?
Right, the 5 books of Moses,
right.
The Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess we could, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
Excellent job.
Yeah, well, I have it in front of me.
Okay.
But is that the theme, the message of Judaism, what's in there?
Okay, so I would say, actually, Judaism is an extra... canonical religion. So what I mean by that is that the Torah, yes, Judaism is tied to the Torah, but Judaism, let me just say this.
Yeah, go ahead.
So when we're talking, I'm going to talk about Judaism, but am I going to try to represent it in a broad sense?
Sure.
But it's really tradition. So it, in some ways, it's hard to define. There's a broad spectrum of Judaism, even today, and there was a broad spectrum of Judaism in ancient times. So when we speak about it, so that, I think that's an important thing to note. And so when you're asking me questions, you're probably going to get 2 or 3 different answers.
Oh, that's fine.
And the answers might be, opposing one another.
Sure.
But in Judaism, the interest is more about truths rather than a single truth. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the way that you look at something, what do you perceive at that moment in your life? What do you perceive? When we study, we tend to study with someone else. So that we bounce off ideas with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So the Torah would form, I would say, yes, the basis of Judaism. But within Judaism, there is the idea of the written Torah and what's called the oral Torah. And according to Jewish custom, not only was the written Torah given at Mount Sinai, but the oral Torah as well, even though that's really a later work. But
we're talking the Ten Commandments?
No. So
okay.
So the written Torah, the Ten Commandments are in the written Torah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, but if you look at the Judaism of the Torah, it's not at all like the Judaism today. It's not even the Judaism of, say, 1,500 years ago, or close to 2,000 years ago. It's a cultic Judaism based on sacrifice. So once the temple is destroyed in 70 of the Common Era, that takes in many of the activities mentioned in the Torah about sacrifice, it's no longer operative within Judaism. So it finds its way within liturgy and holiday practice, but we're no longer going to Jerusalem to offer our sacrifices.
Okay.
So Judaism has to adapt, and it changes. So that's when you have the growth of what we call the oral Torah, which is much more, I would say, about everyday life. So it goes anywhere from issues of holiness and purity to business activities to how we treat one another. So it picks up on a lot of the themes of the Torah, but it really is very much more expansive of that.
Mm-hmm.
And within the and that's defined as what we know as the Talmud. And the Talmud is a combination of 2 ancient works. One is called the Mishnah, which is written down around 200 of the Common Era, and then the Gemara, which is commentary. What's important to note about that commentary is exactly what I was talking about before, is that they list opinions. And they never say, this is the one you're supposed to follow. They just list the different ideas that the rabbis come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And because we try to understand Judaism as a multifaceted gem. Mm-hmm. And if you turn it round and round, you get different. So if you take like a glass prism, mm-hmm. right, depending on how you turn it, you mm-hmm. get different refractions. Mm-hmm. So that's very much about what Judaism is about. So that when you get this oral Torah, you have rabbis over the centuries giving different opinions, and then you have commentary around that, and you have commentary around that. Even with the Torah, there's commentary around that. So, and the commentary is much more, it talks about how it's operative in our lives. So it's, I would say one should stay away from saying that, like if we define Judaism.
I think what you're saying, you're trying to avoid labels.
Yeah, and I would just say if you look at the Old Testament, Judaism is not the Old Testament religion.
And Christianity or Islam, I think all of them, we tend to have labels or stereotypes, and we're trying to avoid that, essentially.
Yeah, we're just not as tied to the text.
As people may think.
As people might think, that text, right, the Torah
right,
text.
Right, okay.
You know, so like when it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth.
Yes, okay? Yes.
We're not
kind of a vengeful God.
Right.
God is a vengeful
right,
God.
Right, which is far from true. And if you look in the Torah also, you'll find something called the Holiness Code, which in 38 places it talks about treating the stranger, caring for the stranger, exactly. caring for the widow, mm-hmm. caring for the orphan. Mm-hmm. So we're always caring for those who are on the margins of society as well.
Right, right.
So yes, there is sort of a warlike God. This is about a conquest.
Right, right.
So
punishing God.
Yeah, well, I would say that.
Just ask the Pharaoh.
Okay, so there's a the idea is there's a consequence to your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so with anything, if you misbehave today, there's a consequence. If you break the law, there's a consequence. I would not say that our society is necessarily a punishing society,
mm-hmm.
but there's a certain order that's mm-hmm. brought to it. So I think that, you know, if you fashion it around a God, right, you have to know that there are certain rules and you're just not going to go break those rules. Because if you do, then your society falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with the eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, rabbis say that's not true. That never really happens. You adjudicate that, and you adjudicate it based on you know, what it costs to care for someone's health, what it costs to cover one's embarrassment or shame, what it costs to compensate someone for loss of wages and future wages. Mm-hmm. So there's different issues that go on in that. So again, so what I'm trying to show you is
starts to approach kind of turn the other cheek, which is
not turn the other cheek.
Okay.
So there's
a boundary here.
There's compensation. So like if you cut off my hand, I'm not going to say, okay, you cut off my hand. I'm just going to say, that's fine. You would then have to you would have to pay for my care.
Mm,
okay. But it's not so judgmental, you know, that, you know, you cut off my hand, I cut off your hand. It's not that type. But what you're seeing is that while it's written in the text, it's interpreted in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's really very operative within Judaism of the centuries.
Now, let's get in kind of the differences in traditions
mm-hmm.
with Judaism and Christianity. What are some of the differences? I mean, we're kind of distinguishing here, but it seems to be more of a fine line. I mean, turn the other cheek. I doubt of what you just said about, you know, someone cuts my hand off, I'm going to be okay with that.
Right.
But let's talk about some of the traditions. What are some of the differences? I mean, I guess we have, you have Passover, Easter, Christmas, Hanukkah.
Okay, so our holidays are clearly different.
Exactly.
And when we talk about a lot of people talk about a Judeo-Christian tradition.
Yes.
I would say that that's not true. It's only true in the way in which perhaps Christianity grew out of Judaism in its early stages. Because Christianity looks at the Jewish Bible as a proof text for Jesus' coming. And the way that a Christian would interpret the Jewish Bible is very different than a Jew would interpret the Jewish Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a broad difference there. So I would say, you know what, the truth is that why we might share the Jewish Bible or the Old Testament
mm-hmm.
Within our sacred works, the way we interpret them is very different, and the way in which we, you know, our beliefs are very different. the reality is that Jesus was a Jew. He started out preaching within the synagogue. But at a certain point in the first century, mm-hmm. there's a split, or there's actually a sort of a genesis, if one, or an evolution, mm-hmm. so that you have Christian Jews or followers of Jesus, and you have non-Jews who become followers of Jesus. You can't put the two groups together because of the Jews who are following Jesus still are Jews. So they're still practicing circumcision. They are well within the context of the church itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, within the context of the synagogue. And so, you know, there's issues of circumcision, of dietary laws and things of that sort. As Christianity develops, there is a clear break.
Okay, what do you mean by there's a clear break? And I assume then we're getting into the fact that, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Maybe I should just ask this. How do you view Jesus? Obviously, you know that he's a historical figure. I'm getting that right now.
Right.
Teacher.
Good Jewish boy.
But son of God?
No.
No. Okay, so, what kind of a man, what do you look, yeah, let's get to the bottom of it, I guess.
Okay, so I'll talk about that as quickly as I can. It's a hard thing. So Jesus, within Judaism, there's always been a concept of a Messiah coming.
The second coming, right.
Well, no, not the second coming. Then we can talk about that in a sec, too. We're still waiting. Jews are still waiting for the first coming.
Right.
Christians are waiting for the second coming.
Right.
So, and we can talk about why that is, and right. I think that's important here. So within Judaism, in what does it mean to be the Messiah? You have to fulfill certain things, or certain things are supposed to happen.
All right.
Okay, so all the exiles are gathered from all the nations around the world. There's a resurrection of the dead. There is peace, world peace, and the rulership is under the single God. And I guess so it's not like Jews are in charge, because we're not, but it's the way in which we follow God that becomes operative. There's also like this kingship. So if we look at Christianity, mm-hmm. and what happened with Jesus, a lot of those things are not fulfilled. So for the Jew,
let's go over that again. The things that are not fulfilled to you are, let's just make sure clarify.
So all the ingathering of the exiles.
What does that mean exactly?
In other words, Jews spread out throughout the entire world. Mm-hmm. Do not all come to Jerusalem.
Okay.
There is not world peace. So the Romans still...
That seems to be the key thing there.
The Romans were still in power.
Okay.
They didn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jew is still oppressed. The dead did not rise up at that point. There's mm-hmm. no resurrection. So those are big things. So for...
That's tough.
Yeah. So for eventually what happens within Judaism and within Christianity, the Christian church, if you will, or the Christian Jew, eventually the focus becomes on the non-Jew. And that's a decision within that early church. For the Jew, Jesus doesn't fulfill those expectations, so that therefore Jesus isn't considered the Messiah, because the things don't happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people who were his followers expected those things to happen shortly after his death, mm-hmm. but they didn't.
So the miracles were not miracles that occurred.
Again, those...
By the way, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No.
I'm just, you know, the walking on water.
Yeah.
Wine, you know.
Okay, so a lot of those... I gotcha. Yeah. So, yeah. I can't comment on that. I don't know.
Right.
I would look at Jesus merely as a charismatic Jew. Whether he's walking on water and things of that sort, we say that we passed through the Sea of Reeds to where the Red Sea,
right.
The Red Sea parted. I don't believe that's true.
The Reed
In
sea,
other words,
yeah.
We create myths. Now,
right.
The myths reflect the idea of a truth, but it doesn't have mm-hmm. to be a true story.
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
a different
right.
type of truth. So right. I'm not going to take literally what it says in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my answer to you is I probably wouldn't take literally what it says in the New Testament.
You're consistent.
Well. So
that Reed Sea is an interesting thing.
Yeah. Yam Suf.
Yeah.
Which means just,
Cecil DeMille, he just screwed it up for all of us, didn't he? I'm sorry. I see Charlton Heston there, and
there
I just
got
there, you know,
that's
man.
Right. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, that did it for me. And later on, you find it's the Reed Sea, you know.
So, right.
Yeah. By the way, maybe we should explain the Reed Sea concept.
Okay, so
go ahead. Yeah.
Yam Suf is translated, often we refer to it as the Red Sea, but it's actually the Sea of Reeds.
Right, right.
So I think that was just an error in like pronunciation or translation at a certain point, and it becomes the Red Sea.
Right,
So anyway.
So they're up to their chest.
You know what? Whether it happened or not.
It doesn't matter. Get back to your original premise. It's the truth.
Correct. There's no proof of it. We don't find it in Egypt.
Right.
So it's not, it doesn't, but it doesn't matter if it happened or not.
Right. And that was your point about whether Old Testament or New Testament. Okay. And we'll get back to the Old Testament.
So within Judaism, since Jesus doesn't fulfill those expectations of the Messiah, Jesus is not the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Christianity needs the second coming, because they need Jesus to fulfill the messianic promises. That's what that in my simple terms. Okay, I'm just a lay person on that. So from that point, you really have a different view of many different things. So as I said, like the Christian or the early church fathers, they all interpret the Jewish Bible differently than a Jew would.
Mm-hmm.
So one is a prediction or a foretelling of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So for the Jew, it's not. And then we have obviously different holidays. So once we don't agree on Jesus,
would you agree though
we
that
go different ways?
I mean, you said he's a charismatic Jew.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe beyond that. I mean, the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, you know, like living the high road, taking the high road, which turn the other cheek. I mean, these types of things can help people guide their life.
Right, but that's not foreign to Judaism.
Okay.
I mean, Jesus talks very much within the milieu of first century Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So it fits, all those things fit perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily unique, but he's taking a certain theological, political bent,
mm-hmm.
one might say.
Mm-hmm.
And so just like today, you know, we don't all say the same things. We have the left, we have the right, we have, you
exactly
know, we
right.
have radical, and we have ultra conservative. So I think that it's important to note that Jesus while he is espousing something that some people might say was radical, I would say he is merely espousing a part of Judaism which he felt passionate about.
Mm-hmm. He took what he thought was the most important part in the text and amplified it.
Right. So, in other words, within Judaism, there's a rabbi, Rabbi Hillel, said, he was asked, encapsulate the whole Torah. What is that? And his reply was, what is hateful to you, do not do to any person. All the rest is commentary. Go and learn it. So, you can see his view of what's hateful, right, very much is love your neighbor as yourself, right? Or as you want to be treated, treat another person. Or as you don't want to be treated, don't treat that person.
Golden rule.
Yeah.
I tell you, we are talking to Scott Looper, rabbi of Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this concept of Jesus, but we're going to get into some other things too, such as social issues, like gay marriage, immigration, poverty, so much to talk about. Don't go away. And that, of course, is music from Fiddler on the Roof. Wonderful song called Tradition. And if you're just joining us, we've been talking about Jewish and Christian traditions and a wide range of topics here with Rabbi Scott Looper of Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. Boy, I like that song. It's really a great one.
You want to dance?
You really do. It's spectacular. Then, of course, is Zero Mostel at the lead. I guess I do want to talk about a couple more traditions, but we are going to get into social issues because that's something that's very important, too. And you alluded to that in the beginning of the program. But Christian and Jewish traditions, and like to talk a little bit about death and, you know, heaven and hell and all that. Of course, we know what, well, go ahead. What do you think are some of the differences there?
Okay. So again, I'm going to try to be quick, simple, but I'm never quick and simple. So here goes. So for the Jew, there's actually different ideas. Once again, I say there's the joke, two Jews, three opinions, but it's really true. That's what it's about. So we actually have four different ideas about what happens when you die. So one is when you die, and you live on in the memories of other individuals. Another is...
Now see, I thought that was it.
No. We got
okay.
more.
Okay, you've got more. Okay.
So another is transmigration of the soul, that your soul is passed from one generation to the next, from all those, starting from the Jews who came out of Egypt.
This is starting to sound a little bit like Christianity. A tad.
Let's say Christianity is starting to sound a little bit like Judaism.
Okay.
Or no, actually, you know what? I take that back, because there is a lot of syncretism and interchange between both faiths.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to be so...
Let's say what you want.
There is the idea of, I'll get to that in a sec, reincarnation.
Yes.
Depending on the work that your soul needs to do, you're reincarnated into something or as something.
That's part of Judaism.
Yeah. So
I did not know that.
If you need a lot of work, you're stuck in a rock. But the deal is a soul that is perfected can come down and free that soul from the rock and sort of take its place for a little while. And then there's the idea of resurrection of the dead, which is, so when we talk about resurrection, you know, and the idea of Jesus being resurrected, that's, again, we're within the milieu of the first century Judaism. So within Judaism, there's the idea that when you die, you get buried into the ground. The reason you're buried into the ground is the ground absorbs impurities. So one, within Judaism, one can die.
Plus you do it right away.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the reason for that?
Well, I would say number one is if you're just, you know, today we have embalming, but it's just a matter of
tradition.
The body starts to decompose pretty quickly. So you probably want to bury pretty quickly unless if you don't embalm. So in that regard, you would want to do it just quickly.
Okay. Yeah, continue. Yeah,
I would just say smell.
Okay. You know? I detoured you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
No problem. So we bury into the ground. The ground absorbs the impurities of an individual. So even if we die with sin, and look at, we all die with sin because we're all within Judaism, we commit sins all the time. It doesn't disqualify us, though, within Judaism. So the ground absorbs those impurities. According to tradition, the souls then rise to the heavens. We can dwell on different levels of heaven. According to this tradition, there are seven different levels, God dwelling on the highest level. And then in the world to come, so Judaism has that idea, in the world to come, which is after either when the Messiah comes or 100 years after the Messiah, you have the resurrection of the dead from Ezekiel, the leg bone connects to the hip bone. We know that song.
By the way, this is starting to sound a lot more complicated than when a Christian dies.
Absolutely. Flesh cleaves, we rise up, we go to Jerusalem, and we're judged. So and the souls descend and go back into the bodies. So those are different ideas about death.
So, but it's not just when you die, because I think that's the stereotype.
Right.
Okay.
So, but Judaism is a very worldly religion, I would say. So the focus is on more on, you know, what we do in this world. Now, there is the idea that we're rewarded in the world to come, but that's the world to come. That's not the idea of, say, we die and we go to heaven and we live in bliss and we're with all our relatives and things of that sort. And that being the real life, I would say, just to be crude in terms of my definition, Christianity would say that, you know, the life in heaven, or traditional Catholicism, life in heaven, that's the real world. And then this is anathema, our world here. Whereas Judaism would say, you know, this is the real experience.
Let's touch a little bit on the history and And believe me, we are going to get into social issues, but I guess I just, I'm trying to clarify a few things.
You can go for it.
Let's go way back into the Bible and I guess the Torah. The Hebrew leader, Abraham, takes his tribe to Canaan, which is now Israel, 4,000 years ago. Now, that piece of land is very, very important to Jews. As a matter of fact, you said you went there when you were a sophomore in high school, and everyone who's Jewish seems to go there. That, why is that piece of land so important? Does it go back to Abraham? Is that the reason?
Okay, so
And if you want to get into Isaac and Ishmael and the whole thing, that's fine.
We can go that too.
Okay.
So just a point of correction. Abraham becomes who is considered the first Jew. And he is told individually. So he's not taking a tribe. God says, Abraham, I'm calling you. Go from your native land, from the place of your birth, your parents' home, to a place that I shall show you. And then God makes a promise. And the promise is, if you do this, I'm making a covenant. I'm going to make you your descendants as great as the sands of the seas and the stars of the heaven, and I'm going to give you this land. This is the deal I make. So, and that comes early in the Torah, after you get through the Genesis myths of creation and the flood. So Abraham goes on his journey. So I would say that, you know, there is that idea of connectedness to the land because that's the initial covenant. That's the promise.
So it goes back to the 4,000 years ago.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, but, you know, and that changes with, you know, as time goes on in terms of modernity and how we view land and people living there. And certainly.
Well, yeah, there's, you got the Arabs.
Well, even before, so we can, you know, when there's going to be the conquest. In the Torah, it says that the land was still populated. There were still the Hittites. There were still the Jebusites. There were still the Perizzites. All these people are still there. So, again, archaeological evidence doesn't seem to prove that there was this just conquest. We walked in and took everything. But there was a slow, gradual conquest from the mountains down to the sea.
In spite of the conquest.
Yes.
Both groups, the Arabs and Jews, go back to Abraham.
Okay.
Because of Ishmael and Isaac.
Isaac. Right. So within Islam, it's actually Ishmael who's being sacrificed and not Isaac who's being sacrificed.
Okay.
So there's a difference in that. But Islam doesn't occur as a religion until around 780 of the before the Common Era, or as others would say, BC. So Judaism is already long in existence. So that before that, you have people who are,
but the Arabs are going back 4,000 years ago too. See,
I would say you have an indigenous people. So there's a bunch of different groups that are indigenous people.
I don't know if that answers my question.
I don't think I. Right. So I think I'm sort of talking around your question there. So I think you're. So the question is, I think what you're asking is,
it seems that both groups
who has claimed to the land.
Exactly. I guess let's not beat around the bush.
Okay.
It seems to me both groups lay claim, and in a sense, as an observation looking in. Both have kind of a right of sort to that land, and maybe that's not the right word.
No, absolutely, I got you.
Okay, because they both go back to that ancestry, or is it more than that?
That's really a complicated.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far.
That's
off,
a complicated one. I
mean, is the whole conflict due to?
It's not due to
but
Abraham.
But it started with that, didn't it? Because everybody lays claim. No, the two groups lay claim.
Well, again, your timing's off, because if you have 780 BCE versus 3000, right? So you're, or 2000, whatever you were talking about, the claims are different in terms of time.
Time doesn't necessarily trump. That's pretty glib.
Yeah. So, well, you know, so within is, again, I'm just going to try to be brief about it. Within Islam, once you conquer, once you have a conquest of a territory, mm-hmm. that becomes your territory within for perpetuity.
Okay.
So within a religious context, it's theirs. Within a religious context, within Judaism, if you want to look at it that way, you would say, well, it's ours. God promised it
right.
to us. And that covenant's never broken.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still, we still have a right to the land. Now, there's people today that say, okay, we can't have biblical Israel. We can have a small piece mm-hmm. of that. There's people that say, well, you know, we want a larger, we want the territories. Judea and Samaria is what they're called within a Jewish context.
Mm-hmm.
Because those were promised by God. Now, I don't go along with that because given where people are and where people are settled, you know, there's a population there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you just don't displace that population. But there's other Jews who would disagree with me. So it's about a 50-50 split in Israel about...
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I tell you, we could go on and on about the two groups.
Yeah.
Let's turn to social issues.
Perfect.
Okay. Well,
but I think it is important to note that Jews do have this strong attachment to the land.
Oh,
and
yes.
As you noted, back yeah. to Abraham and as a promise.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, for people to understand that about Judaism,
mm-hmm.
that it's not just about a modern Israeli state. This
right.
This is our promised, quote, homeland.
This started way before 1948.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. Like I said, let's turn to some social issues.
We can blame the British for that.
Well, yeah. Wow, we can really get into this, can't we? I tell you what, let's get into, though, and maybe this is the best segue, bringing the two groups together and lots of groups together. Interfaith marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you think about that in terms of, you know, Jews marrying Buddhists and, you know, or Christianity and I mean, what, mixed in the two, what do you think about interfaith marriage? How do you, as a rabbi?
Okay, so there, I'll speak from what I do. There's rabbis who agree with me and disagree with me.
Okay,
so within Judaism, there's a ceremony called Kiddushin, which is the sanctification of two people coming together. So the rabbi said, and so we're talking about 1500, 1600, 1700 years ago. The idea of, and then later, that it's two Jews have to marry. Otherwise, it's not Kiddushin.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we live in a culture today where Jews are maritable partners. So Jews, and Jews are no longer, like, we're no longer confined to Jewish neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, people know Jews, people are comfortable with Jewish people. We can belong to all different clubs. We're no longer said you can't come to this hotel mm-hmm. or you can't go to this university, or we don't have those quotas.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the modern American Jew is fully integrated into society. So with that, we send our kids off to college. We've always taught them be open. They meet someone who's not Jewish. And they fall in love.
And thus?
And thus, you have, right, the idea of, you know, what's going to happen. So with the way I look at it is that for me, my work is to guarantee the future of Judaism. So if I'm doing a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew,
mm-hmm.
I'll do it with a commitment that they're going to maintain a Jewish home. Their children are going to be reared as Jews,
mm-hmm.
And that they take an introduction to Judaism class together so that both the non-Jew and the Jew, whose understanding of Judaism is often pediatric, really understand what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't officiate in a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew if they haven't made a decision what they're going to do, or if they say, we're going to go to Christianity, because that's when the decision should be made. We often make decisions based on one another, and we have mutual respect, but we forget that what happens when we have children, and that's the bigger issue.
We are talking to Rabbi Scott Looper. More right after this. Shalom, shalom. pretty song. That's Shalom, My Friend. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Rabbi Scott Looper, sorry about that, of Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. And if you are joining us, we've been talking about, the gamut. We just got into social issues. And we finished talking about interfaith marriage. Let's turn to gay marriage. How does Judaism look at that?
Okay, so once again, we're looking at a broad spectrum. So you're going to get, if you look at you modern society in the United States, I mean, we have different views based on whether we are more conservative or more liberal. I think the whole the movement towards gay marriage is, number one, we recognize that people are born that way, that this is not really a choice. And so I think that's one piece. And being gay or a lesbian is no longer considered a mental illness. At one point it was. And also, I would say that most people are friends with someone who's gay or has a family member who's gay, or, you know, that it's
so
not
the,
like...
What's said in the Torah really...
Okay. So we're going to get there.
Okay.
So if you go to Leviticus, right. It's prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, a man's not supposed to lie
exactly
with another man.
Right.
So, and there's a broad discussion around that. One could take a very textual view and say, that's what it says, that's it, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, Judaism is really, it's a religion that evolves, and it seems from a lot of the stuff that I read that the rabbis are willing to change the rules or the laws based on the exigencies of the time or our understanding. So we're no longer running around trying to kill Midianites, and like the Torah tells us. In fact, so we see this change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that if you want to look at it within context, the Levitical statement is about all the peoples around the Jews at that time period. In other words, don't do what they're doing. And so if you do what they're doing, you might follow what they're doing and no longer follow what the one God wants you to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And those are around prescribed relationships. And... they're called a toiva or an abomination, but even homosexual activity is not considered an abomination against God. It's merely an abomination. So there's different categories. So within that understanding, and based on what we understand today, one could easily say that gay marriage, or even, you know, someone who is gay, right? That's a perfectly acceptable thing. That's
okay,
not
okay. So
counter.
That's the bottom
words,
line,
right? Because there's two arguments. One is about procreation,
mm-hmm.
And we know with today we have all sorts of medical tools to, if a woman wants to, who is married to another woman, and she wants to have a child, she can have a child. For gay men, if they want to adopt children, they can adopt children. And within Judaism, you know, if you're married and you don't have children, that's okay too. So the whole idea of, like, you know, of procreation doesn't really hold a lot of water there. So, you know, there's different views, but I would say within the context of my movement, which is the reform movement, the liberal wing.
So the Orthodox rabbi would say
absolutely
no.
Not.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Conservative.
So you have different strands.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So conservative rabbis, there's a disagreement within that of yes or no.
You know, you write a lot about poverty in your blog.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it's interesting because you grew up in one of the wealthiest counties in California.
Right.
It's obviously a passion for you. You're involved in a number of organizations about that. How'd you get involved in that issue? That's another social issue we're talking about now.
I think if I look at the ills of the United States, I mean, I grew up in a time, yes, I was young in the 60s, but I grew up with that.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up with social change. and watching sort of the fabric of the United States. And even though we've come a long way, we still have a large underclass. And it's so easy, I think, for people to ignore. But I think that my feeling is, until we solve the issue of poverty, we are not going to solve our nation's ills. So
that's the number one issue for you.
That is the number one issue, poverty.
If you want God to answer a prayer, that would be it, I take it.
Oh, I don't know about that. Oh. I guess I
well, I don't
want
to get
okay,
too detailed.
So
again.
I don't want, yeah. I'm not leaving that to God. That's our responsibility. It's okay. Our government's responsibility. It's our responsibility as citizens. The God thing, I would try to deal with global warming. Because to me...
Well, we can stick with the poverty here. Okay. I think I made a detour there. So you're very involved with it.
Yeah.
And...
I'm passionate about it, not to say that...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're a founding member, or I should say, of some of the groups and some of the campaigns.
Right.
Feed the Hunger, that type of thing. Uh-huh. So I got you off track there. I'm sorry.
No problem.
But, how did you get so passionate about it? And that's what you were talking a little bit about, your passion.
Sometimes I wouldn't say that there was a foundational moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think just growing up, Judaism has this idea that you were supposed to care for the marginal, the poor. It says in the Torah over and over, care for the poor, care for the widow, care for the orphan, care for the stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the stranger is an Egyptian, your enemy, you're still supposed to care for the stranger. So that idea is strong within Judaism of caring for other people. I just think that, and I can't tell you when it sort of lit a fire in me, but I feel very much as a society that we have a responsibility for one another. And that's within the context of Judaism, but I think it's also within the context of a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
What are our obligations? How do we care for one another? How do we lift a person up? Judaism says that the highest level of giving is when you give a person or employ a person or teach them a skill so they can have a job. So if we look at the poor, we understand that poor people don't choose to be poor. It's not a choice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And even those who said, well, we're with welfare, we're just creating a generation of, generations of welfare dependency. And especially given the economic situation today, I don't believe that people choose to live in abject poverty. It's an awful, awful, awful situation akin to children suffering post-traumatic stress
mm-hmm.
syndrome. So it has a long overarching effect on the United States and on our future. And so that's why I'm passionate about it, because I think if we don't fix that, we're in for much more dramatic class wars, and also just a nation that fails.
There is so much to talk about. I tell you, we just ran out of time. Doggone it.
Sorry. That was fun. Thank you.
I hope you'll come back. I really, this was just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Again, this was Rabbi Scott Luper of Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. Now, if you'd like to contact him, there is a website, and you can learn more about the Congregation of Or Shalom in Vernon Hills. Just go to the website, www.orshalomlc.org. And again, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.